Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode for today is titled Displacement and the Infrastructures of Care, and I am delighted to have on our episode today Dr. Catalina Ortiz, who is Associate Professor at the Development Planning Unit and the Director of University College London's Urban Lab. Her work focuses on critical urban pedagogy, planning for equality, and southern urbanisms. Welcome to the podcast, Catalina.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me to this very exciting space of conversation.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Your work has been so incredibly interesting for so many different reasons, and I wanted to sort of invite you to help us think about some of the work that you have done and how that's relevant to, you know, our explorations of questions around displacement as well. So I wanted to start with some of the work that you've done in Colombia. And I wanted to ask you, you know, how has the displacement in Colombia shaped the geography of the neighborhood of Moravia, where you've been doing some of this research, in Medellin?
It's, you know, something very important that we need to have in mind when discussing displacement and, you know, the migration patterns in Colombia. To understand the urbanization process of Colombia, it needs to be done through the lens of conflict. So conflict and urbanization basically work in tandem. And Medellin is not the exception and has been one of the cities that has attracted most of internally displaced communities throughout the history of this century. And I think it's very important kind of to have this in mind, because as we speak about how the geographies of the city has been created, and in particular the production of this neighborhood Moravia, we need to understand and locate itself in different ways of migration. So I can think of four very crucial moments. One, let's say, that is linked to the bipartisan violence in, let's say, mid-50s, early 60s, and that is kind of the big wave of migration. Of course, it's more complicated than that. But that is kind of a foundational moment where there was a lot of people coming into the city, basically trying to get their places for inhabiting from scratch. The second wave, I could think, is more towards the 80s, right? When there's also a reaccommodation of powers and in terms of the connection with the guerrilla movements and how that started generating some waves of internal displacement. And then if we fast forward a bit, we can identify that the late 90s and early 2000s, there's a convergence with the paramilitary violence of the country. Of course, I'm summarizing roughly the very complicated conflict in Colombia, but there's a clear connection between these eruptions of political violence with how the cities are being transformed. And I think perhaps the latest wave, it's a very convoluted and complicated way somehow. On the one hand, you get the peace process that occurs in 2016, but also the pandemic, but also the whole crisis in Venezuela that made Colombia one of the biggest receptors of migrant population from Venezuela. And if you think in those kind of four particular waves of moments, that has a complete resonance in how the neighborhood of Moravia has been shaped and the different challenges that has had to endure. So for me, the geography of the place is completely linked and connected with all the ethnicities, the groups, the temporalities. So in a way, you can see the sediment of how conflict and urbanization is been shaping the countries.
Okay. That's really interesting. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering here then about the role of the state. So how has the state responded to these displacements, and how has it also been quite important in shaping the geography of this neighborhood?
Yeah, I think something also very important to consider is that we know that the state is not this monolithic entity, but it's multi-layered, also organism, if you will. Let's say it's more recent that the state has acknowledged the big impact that internally displaced communities have as an object of public policy. So the Constitutional Court, for instance, has played a very crucial role in pointing out to the state the responsibility to deliver and to protect the rights of displaced communities. However, I think something that has been very critical is that the Constitutional Court has found that the state itself has been kind of re-victimizing these communities. And that is very interesting because in the case of Medellin, the local state has been very popular, let's say, among urbanists, in trying to do things a bit differently, trying to pay attention to the very physical material conditions of where self-built neighborhoods. And I think particularly in the case of Moravia, has become a laboratory to test different strategies of neighborhood upgrading, from working with the communities very far along after, let's say, they settled. They tried to test different strategies of working together and recognizing the collective work as part of, let's say, of the payment of the right to be there. So it started to become first the enemy of the people, with the different waves also of trying to clear people from the neighborhood. And it became, let's say, from a very contested relationship, try to work together with the people in allowing and in recognizing the work in the construction of collective infrastructures, particularly roads and water systems. And I think that started shifting a bit the relationship between the local state and the community. But of course, we know that also Medellin has been marked by a very complicated history of violence due to narco-trafficking, militias, so on and so forth. So also that layer has been very, you know, on the one hand, you have this state that is trying to connect and, let's say, support and provide services to the community. But on the other side, you have the policing layer of the state that is also working against what is considered the crime. And it's very interesting how the neighborhood of Moravia became a very important example of creating the first peace negotiations at urban level or a neighborhood level. And I think that is one of the several reasons why I'm so passionate about this neighborhood. And after that, I think the role of the state has been very contradictory, right? In the 2000s, with the kind of rise of the whole notion of the social urbanism, there was a very important investment in consolidating the public, let's say, the collective infrastructures that the community have created, but also providing a very heavy investment in both ecological remediation of the site and also public facilities, and particularly a cultural center that became kind of the hub and a bit of the soul of the collaboration with the state. But more recently, with new occupations in the neighborhood and with the social unrest and the national strike that occurred a few years back, let's say the new face of the state is the state that we knew since the beginning, that is very repressive and not very willing and open to have negotiations. So that's more or less the complicated relationship with the state.
I mean, this is a really interesting sort of background to this. And, you know, given all the kind of work you've done, I'm curious to know, you know, what brought you into doing your research in this area?
Yeah, so, I mean, I lived in Medellin for many years. So in a way, I was a bit of an insider in how the urban planning of the city was coming to be, how it became kind of a paradigm of what needs to be done when it comes to cities in the Global South that were dealing in tandem both with informality and violence. You know, we have a very celebratory story of the city on the one hand, but as a good skeptic and critical urbanist, I was not very happy with it. Basically because I also knew kind of from the inside all the internal contradictions. So I was very interested in understanding and tracing that story and criticizing somehow the best practice approach to planning that I find very, you know, problematic in many ways. I was working understanding how to frame that story differently. What are the other stories that haven't been told? what are the internal contradictions or the caveats of those very interesting, you know, approaches to the role of the state, particularly in cell-built areas. And of course, I became very interested in the territorial strategy of neighborhood upgrading, how they were kind of reconceiving this idea of neighborhood upgrading. And through the collaborative work that I have done with institutions, community organizations, it became very clear that the neighborhood of Moravia was the best space and site to work and understand the urban transformation in many ways. And I think Moravia has become for me like a prism to understand urbanism as a whole, if you will.
So one of the things that you do in this kind of work in Moravia is to look at what you talk about as being these infrastructures of care, right? So I wanted to ask you what you mean by this.
That was not the starting point. As I said, I was more interested in this neighborhood upgrading and what was not acknowledged in the success story of Medellin. And part of the findings, let's say there, is that it was not acknowledged first the collective work that people has been doing before the state showed up. And that was a very key element that when we started tracing the story of Moravia, who were the ones that flew war since the beginning were single mothers, were the widows, were the survivors of the whole conflict. And when you start seeing the neighborhood and buildings, you know, the city from scratch, from the perspective of women that have lost, you know, and are enduring trauma, then for me has shifted completely how you see that neighborhood. And what we started to find out in these kind of learning alliances we have done with the different kind of community organizations is that appreciating and giving visibility to all the efforts that, for instance, Mama Chila did when there was nobody to take care of the children. People had to go and work somewhere else in the informal economy. And it was through the effort of those unknown women that they were able to have childcare, that they were able to create makeshift spaces for education, for the most basic well-being, firstly of children and then from the other generations. And for me, that became fascinating how these kind of both tangible and intangible networks that created the bonds of solidarity were the essential components and that make so interesting this place. And it was a lot the role of women and how they've been crucial not only in building, you know, what I call these infrastructures of care, that I could define them both as these, as I said, tangible and intangible networks of support for life to thrive in a context that is very hostile. They never felt welcome and there was nobody to host them. And I think that became something that I was interested in understanding. What are those networks, those infrastructures, who are leading them, who's involved in this, and what would it mean to understand neighborhood upgrading through the lenses of those spaces, but also those practices, and giving visibility to the ones that have been doing it forever and that are never part of the success story of the city. So some of the questions that came up again and again is, now that has been already 60, 70 years of struggle, you know, who's taking care of the carers? And what happened with all this knowledge about the urban transformation and how they've been fighting for the right to stay put? And I think all this becomes part of the discussion when we enter through the lenses of these infrastructures of care.
So how did you actually do this research?
Yeah, so this is very interesting because, you know, when you introduced me, you mentioned this idea of critical urban pedagogies. And for many people, engaging with pedagogy is something that is, you know, over there is not glamorous, it's just about teaching. But for me, is also both a methodology and a political praxis also in terms of transforming the way in which you understand knowledge, that you create strategies for actually, you know, combating the epistemic violence that we kind of endure when we are, you know, in academic settings. So what we've been kind of putting in place and cultivating is this idea of learning alliances where we are all learning. And in this process, it takes more time, more effort to actually put together what is what we are going to do together that actually is beneficial for the organizations that take part of it. So in this case, because there's an ongoing issue in terms of an eviction threat that is very alive and kicking in the neighborhood, in a way we have become part of that branch that has connections with the academic world, to help create also evidence and tools for them to negotiate with the state. So we have done both during the pandemic, remote work of what we call kind of co-creation, and post-pandemic, going directly and working and doing all sorts of co-design of the methodology with them. And a lot of our results, quote-unquote, are methods, questions of how to work with the community. For instance, how to map the relationship between the body and the neighborhood, emotions and neighborhood. So the questions around tenure is around, you know, like the attachment to place, but how to do it, because we, you know, in my background, I work in urban design, so I have the more visual creative methods. So we have done body territory mapping and all sort of different activities involving painting together. So very creative, very organic at the same time. But I think because we haven't come with an agenda and a fixed question, then we've been able to actually discuss and keep in conversation kind of the direction of the work. And in that process, we develop, of course, these affective connections with people. So I feel accountable to those relationships, and that, in a way, is taking very long to build that trust. And I think the type of things that you connect, you know, is revealed in this process is very different from an approach of the traditional academic that knows exactly what wants to do.
I mean, on that point, I was going to ask, in doing your research, have you been introduced to certain sort of methodologies, certain ways of doing things by the community members that you hadn't considered before?
I think most of the things become new because we were all experimenting. And I think that the power of the community researchers is usually not fully understood or appreciated by people. But for instance, having these, you know, different iterations of type of questions that you can ask to women in terms of the relationship of, you know, the trajectories of tenure in the neighborhood, for instance. You know, this idea of, let's go there, let's bring people we know, let's test it, and then let's do it again next day with someone else that we don't know. You know, these very mundane, yeah, practical things that are so valuable in terms of kind of the ethical, yeah, protocols that you need to unfold. And something that the last encounter we had is that all this element of bringing the idea of emotions, you know, and how do you deal with places that are marked by trauma, and that, you know, you cannot just go with the traditional toolkit of urban design to say, okay, here we're going to do a boulevard, because it doesn't really hold in that aspect if you don't understand that invisible connection to the places of fear and danger. We had to work around healing and how to create kind of safe space to avoid re-victimizing when you are bringing traumatic events. So we work with, you know, color coding, and it was endless discussion about what are the colors that write the emotion that we want, nice, to bring about. And community members were very clear about, you know, the symbolism, how, you know, you need to be very precise, mm-hmm, and not, you know, misleading people. So those things, perhaps you couldn't have this type of conversation with someone that, yeah, is not, you know, very connected to the sensibilities of people.
I guess probably as a final question then, I wanted to just ask what you think this kind of approach to infrastructures of care can do in terms of helping us think, or rather rethink, our ideas of displacement.
I think on the one hand, it allows us to start from the space of agency of people. And I think that, you know, it opens up a whole set of possibilities. But also, if we center what some have called, you know, the life-affirming infrastructures, then you are centering life instead of re-victimizing people or just thinking that they are, you know, passive subjects that are waiting to be saved. You know, you completely get away from it. And it really allows you to value the effort, the knowledge, and the whole imagination people has developed to actually survive and thrive and transform places. And in particular, in the case of Moravia, how the intergenerational learning is so essential to keep fighting for the right to stay put, because it's not something that gets settled, but only mutates. And I think when we're talking of care, we are talking also about the politics of space production and the relationship with the state. And here, because it's very entangled with violence, I think the solution to violence is not repression, mm-hmm. but more care, yeah. right? And I think that helps us to shift the conversation and therefore, hopefully, the type of investments and the priorities of public policy.
Wow, that was really, really interesting. This is such interesting work and quite a different way of thinking about many of these questions. I really enjoyed all aspects of it, but that methodology question was particularly interesting and really makes me think about, you know, how we do research. What does it mean to actually do sort of community-led research and think about what it is that the communities prioritize instead of us? Thanks so much, Catalina, for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the conversation. It's been a pleasure.